Welcome to KROV Oroville, 91.1 FM, community radio here, originating from Oroville and extending to as far as our signal will reach, which is pretty far because we do have some internet streaming at times. All these things are a part of a community effort to provide a radio station whose origination is really right here. All the programs originate here. Some of them are pre-recorded. Some of them might be nationally recorded and originate here, but they are chosen carefully as representatives of what this community station stands for. And now we do have, we'll get this mic turned on. Oh, I can hear it's working. Today we have special guests, Daryl and Olivia, or Olivia and Daryl Grieco. I always have a problem. This business of, you know, does the male go first? Baloney. This is the world. People are just people. And the order in which they're mentioned is not anything to do with the order of their importance. That sermon is over. And so let's say hi and somebody speak to me over there.
Good morning.
Okay.
If we go most senior, we would introduce Daryl first. So that's okay. He's 6 months older than I am.
Oh.
But here, Olivia Newsom Grieco here. And I am so thrilled that you've asked us to come at this particular time. We have Berkeley Olive Grove that was planted in 1913. So right now, in 2013, our grove has reached its centennial. So we're very, very thrilled to come and talk about it. And Sunday, May 19th, we had our first open to the public where they could come and tour, hear the history, hear about our sustainable practices, and taste our olive oil, which is premium. We got three gold medals this year, and we are currently on three lists of international, well, it's called Great Olive Oils of the World, from Flossolet, and that's from Italy. We don't get on that list easily. We are on Great Olive Oils of the World from a list that Tom Muller put together. It's called Truth in Olive Oil. His book, Extra Virginity, started talking about fraud around the world in olive oil, and then he put together, and here's some premium olive oils, and then he put five stars after the name of our company.
Could I interrupt right here, because this rings a bell with me. There's been a lot of talk about honey and imported honey, and what they've been doing with that is they've been checking the various pollen, because there's always a little pollen in it. And if it doesn't originate in the country where they say it originated, and they, you know, then they have problems. So I'm wondering, when you say fraud in olive oil, I know it's not your topic maybe, but how about it? Tell me about fraud in olive oil.
I'm going to let Daryl talk. He is a data gatherer on the research. So go ahead.
Yeah, all right. You have to move up. I'm sorry.
All right. I'll come a little closer here.
You guys are pretty good friends. Okay.
38 years.
You can do one of these numbers. You can pass the mic back and forth, too.
If you can hear me.
Fine.
Basically, olives came to America in the 1700s and California in the 1700s with the missionaries. The very first olives came to the New World in between 1495 and 1510, but those olives probably went to Central America and South America. However, olives have been around here for a long time, and in the 1800s, there was an attempt to develop an olive oil industry here in California. And as far back as around 1900, there was a USDA, and it was known at that time that most of the oils coming here from Europe were actually faulty oils, but they were cheaper than what we could produce here. And so the local oil industry didn't survive as anticipated. There was a resurgence in the beginning in the late 1980s. And Tom Muller, that Olivia mentioned, he wrote a book that went to the bestseller list, Extra Virginity, talked about fraud in olive oil, and there are several reasons for this occurring. But the short of it is, in 2010 and then again in 2011, UC Davis released reports They had tested a broad range of olive oils that they purchased and ran through their labs and labs in Australia. The first time they did it, 69% of the olive oils that were tested coming here from Europe failed to be extra virgin. The second time, 73% failed to be extra virgin. And this can happen for several reasons. One is if it's out and out fraud, it's a fairly legal way to be fraudulent, not have great consequences. If you're dealing with drugs, cocaine or something, and you get caught, it is severe. But with olive oil, it's just olive oil, and it's no big thing. But Tom Mueller has likened the profitability of fraudulent oil, olive oil, to the drug trade coming from Colombia. It's enormous. And so that's one of the reasons. Another more benign reason is that it's actually a long, hard trip from the origins of the olives and the olive mills, making the olive oil, and then to the ports where they're going to be exported, and coming across the ocean on top of a ship, and then to the ports here, and then to the warehouses, and then finally to the store. Those oils are subjected to long conditions that are not advantageous to olive oil, and they can break down. So those are the two principal reasons for fraud in olive oil.
Obviously, when you have something, I won't say grown within a stone's throw, but mighty, mighty close to home, we don't have those considerations.
No, and actually, there is a California Olive Oil Council, which is really designed to develop to promote California olive oil. But if you look for the California Olive Oil Council seal on a bottle, not all California producers are going to have that, but it's pretty much a guarantee that that is a tested true extra virgin olive oil that you want to buy.
Okay. I think Olivia's chewing at the mic. I can see this expectant look on her face. Go for it.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the history. Daryl was talking about the research and the concerns about fraud. In 1897, USDA and UC Berkeley Ag Experiment Station got together with a laboratory, and they pulled olive oils off the shelves and out of the custom house, and they tested imports, and they tested California oils. And in 1903, the report was submitted to Congress about what was going on, and Congress made a proclamation that California agriculturalists should be planting more olives because the oil was substantial quality, and that there was room for California to take care of the domestic desire for a quality olive oil. So there were professors at the UC Berkeley campus that got a hold of this research and then took it a couple steps further. Some of the professors from UC Berkeley went to Italy and Spain to learn about where to plant, how to plant, the whole olive culture, and then they decided to make growing olives their retirement investment. So several professors went ahead with this, and a local person found the perfect place, a Mediterranean climate belt. Here in Butte County, there are five around the world, and we have one of those Mediterranean climate belts. So the land was subdivided, and the person who did this for him is a whole other interview. I will just mention his name, and I won't go any further. His name was Bert Bookham Meek, very substantial person in history. Anyway, he and his partner found the land, subdivided it, and guaranteed that he would plant the trees and take care of them for the professors until the trees were ready to produce. When the professors began to be involved with it, when the olives began to produce, they would come up during the harvest, they'd come up in the summers, and they would work the land. They called the grove Berkeley, they called the project Berkeley Olive Grove, and we've kept that name. We just added 1913, so we call it Berkeley Olive Grove 1913 because the year of planting, we believe, is significant. When they planted, there's an interview which I found in the Butte County Historical Department, wow, dusty old box, that I found a newspaper article that said one of the professors were speaking for the group, said, "This is our 1,000-year project," because olive trees planted the way these are, traditionally planted, could last 1,000 years. And so they went forward with their 1,000-year project. And we've taken this on ourselves to have this here in the future, and we're putting all of the 400 acres that we have in conservation. This will always be agricultural. It will never be developed. And maybe here would be a good time for Daryl to talk about some of our sustainable practices with the grove, a traditional grove, maybe comparing it with the new industrial-type groves that are being planted in California, which do bring nice olive oil, but Daryl could maybe contrast those.
Okay.
Sounds great.
Okay. There actually is a very distinct difference between agriculture that was the normal agriculture and what is now called commercial agriculture or industrial agriculture that began roughly the time of World War II. And it was based on cheap fossil fuels. And from petroleum products, you can make fertilizers, but you can make pesticides and herbicides and so forth. And with these artificial, I would like to term them artificial means of controlling the environment and boosting production as well, they were able to concentrate the number of plants, whether they're trees or whatever. In our case, it's trees. So they would plant more and more of them. But those trees were, in commercial agriculture, those trees are dependent on the supplements that you give them. Before that, trees, for instance, were planted according to how they could survive in nature. If you think of like an oak tree, you see all these oak trees in there. They are spaced in a way that they can survive for a long, long, long time. They can get the nutrients, the water, the whatever they need from the spacing that they have. So in our case, we date back to the traditional agriculture, and our trees are approximately 65 trees per acre. And these trees right now are surviving in nature without supplements and without water even. We do not irrigate. This is called rain irrigation or dry farming. So we have 65 trees per acre. The new commercial super high density groves have, instead of 65, they have about 620 trees per acre. So my take is that I would rather have food coming from a product that is kind of raised by nature rather than raised by man and what man gives to the plant. You're only going to get back what you give it, and nature gives it everything. And I don't know that we know how to test that in the lab yet, but my theory is that a more healthful food comes from traditional agriculture.
One thing really hit with me, and I know this is an olive oil program, but when you said you don't water, what about the future? I mean, there are political threats to the water. There are aims now to build a big tunnel to take water out of the Sacramento River and so on, and to take the aquifer, they call it exercising, and pump that out too, and sell that south. So, and of course, we've had a couple of dry years so far in a row. Do you feel any qualms, number one? But beyond all that, what about from a practical farming point of view? If you're concerned at some point that you have to provide water for your olive grove, is there any way of knowing when? Can you just look and sort of touch a tree and tell? You know, I'm not trying to be silly. You get what I mean?
No, no, no.
This is a real serious, this to me is scary.
There are times in the cycle of the annual cycle of the tree that it definitely would be advantageous if the tree has a good supply of water. Principally, it's at the time of bloom, it's very nice to have the tree be in prime condition, so well watered in March, April, May. That's very important for the crop to develop. A little bit of water through the middle of the summer is helpful to continue the development of the maturation of the olive, the development of the olive. And then about at just before harvest time, that helps finish the olive oil content in the olive and allows them to come off the tree more readily. But We don't actually have any water at this point, and so we do face a little bit of problem. We have to, for instance, harvest. We have to wait until after the first rains. If we were irrigated, we could begin harvesting earlier. However, this is a 100-year-old tree that we're picking an olive from, and is producing some of the, you know, the fine olive oil in the world. On a super high density grove, for instance, if we don't have a water supply here, I don't know how they survive. So right now, that would turn the tables.
Gotcha. That would
turn the tables. Our challenge right now is to survive until people understand the value of the kind of oil we produce and the variety, the greater variety than just what super high density can produce. But on the other hand, if there weren't water, then we would be in the driver's seat.
Sure. Okay, that's interesting, and it obviously, in a way, the question didn't need to be asked, because look what you're doing with what you have. Look what you're doing with that water. You can pat yourself on the back for your awards and for the quality of your product, and feeling undoubtedly really good about it.
There is an aspect that showed up that we found out about when we were a little bit forced to be dry farmed, that I would like Daryl to talk about. And that is, when you have dry farmed mature trees and you are testing for the different benefits that this olive and this oil can provide, we discovered that this little bit stressed tree is higher in antioxidants, higher in polyphenols. And I'm going to stop there and let Daryl talk about the polyphenols and what that means in your diet and for your body based on cause and effect science. There's a lot of research out of Europe, but I'm going to let Daryl talk to that.
Well, basically, there have been many, many studies, trying to figure out the health benefits of the components of olive oil. Olive oil has been considered a positive thing basically for three reasons. One is it's principally a monounsaturated fat, which is a good thing to work with. Monounsaturated fat, for instance, with regard to cholesterol, will raise all fats that you might cook with will raise the good cholesterol. But all except olive oil and maybe just a couple like avocado oil will lower the bad cholesterol instead of raise it, as all the others do. So that component of olive oil has been considered important. There is a secondary component of olive oil, which are tocopherols. Those are E vitamins, omega 3 and 6 principally. And they have their advantages, and they are antioxidants. But the principal component of olive oil that has been good for health, and people have been researching, has to do with polyphenols. Polyphenols means many phenols, and there are groups, specific phenols, excuse me, in the array of phenols that have been thought to or known to be beneficial to the body. In the end, though, in Europe, they basically said, we're not going to sanction a specific statement saying this phenol is good for this specific purpose in the body, and that's good for that specific purpose. What we're going to say is, without question, without doubt, it's incontrovertible that the polyphenols is what's important for health in olive oil. And that's not questioned. So, with regard to our olive oil, Mission is a variety that is by nature higher in polyphenols than many other varieties. And the flavor component of polyphenols tends to be bitterness and pungency, sort of that pepperiness in olive oil. And for the longest time, people have really not wanted that. So the traditional way of producing Mission olive is to wait until the fruit is very, very ripe, fully black, very end of the season, and then they would make the olive oil, and that becomes like a soft, buttery, sweet oil, which is you think of as great for dipping. And it is great for dipping. It's a very nice flavor, but you've eliminated. You've passed the period of the healthfulness, which are the polyphenols. And if you think of what, you know, for instance, an Italian olive oil from Tuscany, which is considered to be very great, all of those are very strong peppery oils. They're higher in polyphenols. So back to what UC Davis tested in 2010 and 11, they did include polyphenol levels, and the average of what all of the olive oils that proved to be extra virgin was 222, let's say parts per million on the Gallic scale, 222. The average of the super high density olive oils that they tested was 92, and our average that year was, I think it was 378. And they only tested two oils that were in the range of what we did. We weren't one of the ones that they tested, but that's what our lab analysis showed that year. So the high polyphenols, without saying specifically what it's going to do for the body, it does good things for the body. And I like to talk to people about the fact that if you're using a high polyphenol olive oil when you're cooking, the antioxidant, that protective quality of the antioxidants, when you're cooking with that oil, it serves to protect the nutrients in the food you're cooking. So you're kind of giving up the flavor, but you're actually saving the nutritional value of what you're cooking. When you're finished cooking, you have more food value. And then if you add an olive oil as a finishing oil and drizzle that on top, that's the fresh, raw, alive enzymes that are going directly to your body to do what you decide to do.
Okay, so you're that's just what I was going to ask, and you kind of answered it. There are certain things about cooking that are helpful, but they may not be quite as perfect as the balance between part cooked and part uncooked.
Right.
That seems to be the epitome of what you can get nutritionally from the olive oil.
Well, you know, there are many kinds of olives, olive varieties, and, you know, olive oils, and we happen to have Mission, but I'll tell you frankly, in our cupboard we have always, you know, like a half a dozen different olive oils, and olive oils besides our own are always there. And it's nice to have a variety of flavors. But with regard to adding olive oil to the finished product, about 70% or maybe more of what you taste is actually what you smell. And so when you pour olive oil over the cooked food, it releases those aromas. You smell more of the food, and those olive oil flavor smells too. And you're actually going to enjoy what you're eating more. So that's just a little bonus besides the live enzymes that are going into your body.
Okay, our guest today, by the way, this is still KROV Oroville, 91.1 FM Community Radio. And our guest today from the Berkeley Olive Grove, 1913, a very young grove, so we're told, says it's only 100 years old, for heaven's sake, Jarrow and Olivia Grieco. Continue, folks. This is a very interesting story.
Well, we have opened our grove up to the public, as I said, and since it's mostly Jarrow and Olivia doing everything, you will need to call before you stop by, because we could be out in the grove or out delivering oil. But when we're there, we are happy to have people come by and be guided through tasting of a premium olive oil. And Daryl mentioned 70% of the oil is in the aroma, and I like to say it's 80 or higher, even 1,000 receptors in your nose. So when we're tasting an olive oil together, I put it in a little tasting cup and have you warm it just a little by swirling it the way some people do wine, and take a moment to smell that aroma before you put it in your mouth with either bread, which I will provide, or just put it in straight so you can pick up more complexities. And when the oil is on your tongue, you'll pick up, just like high antioxidant, arugula, or dark chocolate, you will pick up bitter on your tongue, and that's a positive attribute. Then after you swallow the oil, it takes a few drops to actually get down to the back of your throat for you to pick up where the pepper receptor is. And if it's a very high, robust antioxidant, very high in antioxidant olive oil, you're going to get some pepper and maybe cough a little bit. And when we're with olive oil people at some event, say a release of a new book or a new report is out, there usually is a buffet table where we are all invited to bring our oils and share with each other. And at that meeting, if you're tasting someone's olive oil and you cough, they will high-five each other about the quality of the olive oil.
Wow.
They don't believe it that it's a premium unless you're going to be getting some cough and maybe, you know, a little bit
wow.
water in the eyes. So we invite you to come and be with us and share that experience.
What a story that is.
I would like to add just a little bit here because sometimes you can be thrown off by tasting olive oil straight. Olive oil really is best as a component with food. And there are, you know, three components of olive oil that has to be there to be a great olive oil and to get high awards. Fruitiness, that every, you know, that olive-y flavor that everyone thinks of, it's only one of the three. The second one is bitterness, it has to be there. And the third one is pungency, which is what Olivia's calling pepperiness. Those have to be there, and they have to be there in certain balance. But the reason you have to have bitterness and pungency along with the fruitiness is that as a food component, like it's a seasoning, and that's the bitterness and pungency actually lifts the flavors of the food you're cooking and enhances them. If you have just a very soft oil and you add it to food, you're going to end up with basically an oily, greasy food.
Gotcha.
If you add a little salt and pepper, it you know, it brings it up. And so tasting olive oil straight, you just have to keep in mind that what would it be like if it were with food?
That's a very, very good point. I think I picked up on that one really well because... Yes, when you say it's a seasoning, it's not like you've got a plate and this is your supper tonight and you drink olive oil. It's like you've got foods, and what do you put on them? A little salt, a little pepper.
Well, and so beyond that, I do one other thing too, which might be unique with my company. I don't know our company. We have one olive variety, but from that, I make all three flavor intensities so that you can pair the
wow.
appropriate food oil with the food that you're cooking. So I make a delicate olive oil, a medium intensity oil, and a robust oil. And so now you can pick the oil that you want for what you're cooking and enjoy it the most.
Chemistry? Sounds like a lot of chemistry involved in this agriculture. But is it seat-of-the-pants chemistry, though, right, for you to pick these different... ones, you do it by, I guess, taste and timing rather than any kind of chemical procedure.
The timing, exactly right. An earlier harvest, say a November harvest for Mission, is going to be very strong. So Darrow is harvesting in November and sending it to the lab. We have a wonderful lab in Durham, Ag Biolab. They're testing different components, especially we're focusing on polyphenols, and they are maturing, and we're waiting until they mature and actually hit their peak, and then Darrow goes for that. But you're right about the tasting. It's not just that we're looking for polyphenols. We're looking for a balance of the aroma and bitter and pepper, a beautiful harmony. And more people call and say, please harvest more of your high polyphenol olive oil. It's what our customers are looking for health benefits. And then Darrow will continue harvesting. And in December, this is a little bit rounding up of information. In December, we usually get our medium intensity, which is a balance between what then becomes our delicate later December or January oil. And the December one is the most complex usually because we taste all the different harvest dates and find the one that is a balance of aromas from early and late, and then balance the bitter and pepper with that perfectly. And Darrow has said, if that's complicated and if I can't get it balanced perfectly, I'll skip making it. And this year we actually had it from a single day. There it is. There is that medium. And
yeah, usually it's a blend. Each of our oils blends oils that have been milled on different dates. We might have 20 different dates. And you know, the first third would go toward the robust, the last third would go to the mild, the middle third would go to the medium. But to balance those out, to round them and try to get a good balance, we'll take a little early with and add it to the late, for instance, and a little of the late add to the early. The mid is actually the most difficult to make because it's in between and you have to get the right balance. But that's what we do.
And something I'm getting a picture of, obviously, you have control over your entire operation, but obviously it's not on the farm. It's not like another place where you go there and there's the chickens and they give you the eggs. You get the olives, but then you've got processing, you've got testing, you've got you've got to have a lot of people that you rely on to really do a good job for you.
Well, also the milling process is a very critical component, and I'm pretty hands-on with that, and it might be different from most producers in that regard. I've gone to master milling classes at UC Davis numerous times, but the way in which you crush the olive is critical to the whole rest of the process, for instance. You have to get that right. If you don't get that right, then you just end up with what you have. You cannot bring it back once you've done it wrong. But there, olive oil extraction is essentially, there are four phases there, but each one you can make choices as to how you do it, and it's not just seat of the pants so much. You have to understand why you would do each thing and what responds to what, and then you make your choice.
It makes me wonder when I think of the ancientness, which isn't the right word, but you know what I mean, of olive oil, how somebody without modern technology, what do you suppose the olive oils were like, the first ones that were harvested way back in, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
They couldn't do all these things. How did they do this?
The best olive oil possible in all of history is what's made now. But, you can do basically anything and you're going to end up with olive oil, and it probably will be satisfactory if you avoid basically the things that make the olive oil rancid or fusty or musty or something like that. With regard to how things were done long ago, people think of the big stone wheels and the screw presses, and we have a term, first cold press olive oil, and it comes from that long period of time when the olives were put in a stone bowl and these big wheels would crush the olives, and then that crushed olive paste would be put between mats and then screwed down, and the first oil that squeezes out of that, that's the first cold press olive oil. There are two disadvantages of that process, and that's why olive mills today are different from that. But the stone mills make a softer flavor for the oil, but it takes a lot longer, and so that paste is oxidizing that whole time. It's breaking down. And then when you squeeze it through the mats, the first time or two or three or four or five, it's fine, but eventually those mats become rancid, and without replacing the mats, you can't take that away. So even if you're starting with good oil, it's going through a rancid mat. We don't have to do that now until we have better olive oil.
Okay, yeah.
There's another thing that can occur if, as Daryl's talking about, you just get oil. You can get more oil from the pulp by adding water to separate more of the oil out of the what's been crushed. But polyphenols are water soluble, and since our big focus is preserving the polyphenols, we don't add more water. And you can also get more oil by bringing up the heat, but it's at the cost of the polyphenols, so we don't do either of those things. We keep it at low heat and we keep it without adding extra water. Daryl's made quite a science of this, all things polyphenol. And it's a new thing for many people to be tasting something that has an aroma of wheatgrass or artichoke and bitter on the tongue and pepper after the swallow. But what I just described to you sounds just perfect to me. And more people are looking for that. I'd like to continue with our practices. Besides in the milling, there are things that Daryl does on the land. Well, it sounds like you're a busy boy to me.
He is.
We put back on the land what we're taking off. We are still working on how to chip a hardwood and get it back on the land without it making little hardwood knives that go into the harvester's tarps. So we're still working on that. But everything that, and we're working with probiotics and biochar. There are different things that we can do, but we want everything back on the land. We're certified organic. We do not use any sprays of chemical sprays at all. We have goats eat the berry vines and the star thistle. We have cows chomping down the grass. So we're not using any chemicals at all. It makes a difference. We have wildlife in the grove, which when you come to visit someday, but call first, you probably see deer, quail, dove. And right now we have a lot of wild turkey. So and in the evening, in our area, in our neighborhood, there's a lot of coyotes, and they sing about where they live. So it's charming. So we're, anyway, our practices, we have the wildlife, we have the certified organic, and we have the dry farming. And that's going to make a difference in the quality of your experience when you come to visit the grove and when you taste the oil. We had a gentleman come from Italy who has made his name in olive oil, and he's made his money, but he wanted, as a new mission, to put olive oil on the menu the way wine is. You pair different wines at different foods, and his goal was to have it be that you pair different olive oils with different foods. And he came to visit with his translator and looked over the grove, and he said, the way this grove was planted, the spacing of the trees, the soil, the climate, the alignment, is exactly what they would do with what they have as olive culture knowledge today. And then we had his land manager come and help us with the pruning. So we're very sustainable. The other thing is that this grove has been here a long time, and with these natural practices, it turns out that some trees were self-planted, selected by nature. And so we have trees that are not exactly the mission that were planted 100 years ago. And with those mature, well, they look a little bit like shrub. There's no taproot on these. I would like Daryl to talk to you about what he did this year, unique, in the whole nation, maybe in the world. Go ahead, Daryl, talk about this.
Okay. Well, the type of olive that we know is Olea europaea. I don't know if I pronounce that correctly, but something like that. There is one other species that of Olea that's in the Baltic region of Europe. But all of the olive oils that we've ever tasted come from the one genus. However, all of the oils that we taste come from specific varieties, and the specific varieties of olive oils are developed by man. We select and select and select until we get exactly the best tree, the best biggest olive, or the most oil, or the best flavor, or whatever, harvest early or something. But if an olive from a mission, ours are mission olives, if that olive goes to the ground and grows as a shrub, and olives are technically shrubs, actually, not trees, it will come back not true to type. It won't come back as a mission. It's mission parentage, but it comes back, it reverts to a different form. And we have about 50 or 60 of these wild shrubs on our property. And so this year, I've been wanting to do this for a few years, but this year I did it. I harvested all the olives that were produced by those trees. Each tree is different from the one adjacent to it, but I had just enough to do a batch. And we only made, from this entire batch, 15 gallons of olive oil. And I have learned from a prominent expert in olive oil, both American and worldwide. He says that no one else has done this, has made olive oil from these, I'm just going to call them wild because it sounds better than feral, olive trees. It has been done in the past in Australia. It's not being done right now. And so that would mean that I'm the only one in America that's made this kind of olive oil this year, at least. I entered this at the New York International Olive Oil Competition recently, and it won a gold medal. It was considered one of the great olive oils of 2013.
What a story. I got to interject a little bit here because from a knowledgeable person, which to me was knowledgeable, same thing with apples. If you got this wonderful apple tree and you take the seeds and plant them, good luck. It isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen. So that's an interesting facet of nature that a lot of people don't appreciate when they're used to being able to take a cutting or take a slip or take a leaf from something and plant it and grow it and eat it. And that actually, wow, that's quite a story. That's quite a story.
To go with that, when you come to visit us, we don't have very much of this left because 15 gallons doesn't go for very long when people fall in love with it. Someone asked us if he could buy 10 gallons of it. I go, no, because we'd like to share more. But when you come, I will, of course, start you with pouring the olive oil into a little tasting cup and swirling around and getting the smell. And that smell, that aroma, it's unique to Darrow and to me. We've never had such an experience. It's like breathing a new bouquet of lavender, roses, and then you smell a little cinnamon and mint. And then when you put it on your tongue, it does have the bitter, and after the swallow, it does have the pepper. The polyphenols were 415, so that's pretty high, with the average being 222. It was pretty high, but it's balanced. And when you put it with food, it brings out flavors in a way that's unique to it. Darrow made a vegetable soup, and actually it was such a delicate ingredient that I didn't even know he had put fennel in there until I poured the wild olive oil in the soup, and it like popped the flavors alive. So it's delicious, and again, we are open to the public. It's just that you'll need to call, and I hope you come and taste our oils.
Hold it. There's something we're missing here. We're missing a contact phone number and an address. Now, maybe forget the address because you don't want to just go there, but maybe you should just do a little geographical help here for folks.
Okay, our phone number is 533-1814, okay. 533-1814, and we're situated at the lower end of Coal Canyon Road, basically Table Mountain Boulevard and Coal Canyon Road. So the easy way to get there, fast way, is go up Highway 70, passing 149 to Chico, and there's a traffic light on Highway 70 at Clark Road, turn off to Paradise to the left, and if you turn to the right, that's Table Mountain Boulevard. You take that, it goes right back to Coal Canyon Road. So that's how to get to us. Olivia was talking about the wild, but I want to mention we also now, this is our first year of producing it for ourselves. We have citrus-flavored olive oils, and I made a Lisbon lemon, a Meyer lemon, and a blood orange. We're totally sold out of the Lisbon lemon, but we have Meyer lemon and blood orange. But I have to say that although I haven't been an ice cream eater for a long time, probably my favorite food in the world right now is vanilla ice cream with blood orange olive oil on it. It is. Wow. That might sound strange, but try it once.
All right.
When those are made, they are co-milled. So all of the oil that we make is certified organic, and we source certified organic citrus. So they're milled at the same time, and it's absolutely amazing. And the Meyer lemon, well, it goes on my salad. I don't need any other thing to go on it, just the Meyer lemon. So this month we are profiled in the Buy Fresh, Buy Local Eater's Guide to Local Food. On page 21, there's a story about us and our practices. And also this quarter, we are profiled in the Butte County Historical Society Diggins. It's the story of Berkeley Olive Grove. So every page but the last one is about us. And we had kind of set it up on the history of olives and olive oil in California, and then it came to us, and then we talked about our future ideas. Darrow mentioned about knowing about olive oil in 1900. Well, in California, olives were planted increasingly at the Gold Rush and at statehood, and it was very common for olive oil to be on a pharmacist's shelf. There was a pharmacist that had it on his shelf. He had a grove, he had a mill, and he sent his oil to the Paris Exposition in 1900, and that olive oil won the grand gold medal. This is always blind tested. I'm just like oils from California being sent to be tested against the European ones. It was a surprise for a lot of people that a California olive oil won the grand gold medal. And then we know in our area that Frieda Eamon worked on and got a recipe, and that also was from UC Berkeley, a professor there that helped her perfect that recipe, and did very, very well. But they also made some oil in limited amounts, and the Eamon oil in the 1915 Pan-Pacific Exposition got a gold medal. So we, for a long time, the oil's been fine. It's tricky to compete on cost. So we're hoping for a more level playing field by getting a federal marketing plan in place, and that takes all of the producers to agree that we will monitor ourselves, and when we monitor ourselves with standards, then they become applied to imports, and then the consumer will really get what they believe they're getting, because what it says on the label hasn't always been true. But with the federal marketing plan, we expect that to tighten up a lot, and I'm hoping that comes very soon.
I would like to add just one final thought. I touched on it earlier, but when you consider the cost, when you're eating, consider what you're paying for the food that you're eating, and then consider the cost of the olive oil that you're using with that food. The value of a high polyphenol, high quality olive oil preserving the nutritional value of the food you're eating is well worth the difference, and it actually is even though you might not want to spend more than $5 for a bottle of olive oil, you're getting more than that additional money's worth, because you're getting it back in food value.
Good point. Wow. Very interesting. And by the way, we do have a website, and we're in the process of posting these interviews there. So this will not be lost, this interview. I'm watching the little monitor here and the little squiggles going back and forth saying it's being assimilated into our computer, and we will be having these on our website so folks can hear them at their leisure. And it's been a real fine morning here. Berkeley Olive Grove, 1913. 100 years young, which is really, really, that's endearing to me, because there's so much I can't describe it, but you know it. Everything's replaced by something, by something, by something, and it's like, how fast can you replace it? And this is better because it's newer, and what a horrible mindset. Well, you know, as some people would say, I'd like to be able to have access to all the things that people have thrown away in the past, and some of which are irretrievable. So you folks are doing quite a job, and obviously your plan is not plant more trees, for heaven's sakes. I mean, you've got it made. You've got what you need to produce what you have to do. We got 5 minutes, and I got to do this. It's just sort of my general question, how and why you guys in this grove. I mean, there must have been something you didn't say when you were a kid in school, you know, going to second or third grade. Someday, what I want to do is grow olives. I mean, is there just a brief thing you could tell us about it?
Well, when Darryl first saw the grove, he was coming from a real estate background, had done very well in real estate, owned apartments and commercial land. And when Darryl saw the grove, it was in 28 parcels, because different professors owned it privately. It was managed commonly, but it was owned privately. So we had these legal parcels, and Darryl had some very particular thoughts, which I'll let him describe to you. And I want to mention, we have a website, berkeleyolivegrove.com, and Berkeley has three E's, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, berkeleyolivegrove.com. And we have a Facebook, so you could find us there, too, for what's coming up. And then I'm going to pass this over to Darryl about his what was going on with his thoughts. But we have some events coming up, because I know once I pass this over, that's it for me. We have some events coming up in the fall. We're inviting the public again to come and visit us. in time for hand harvesting, likely November, but the Grove will determine exactly when that's going to be. And we have Carol Ferenzi, who wrote the book Passionate Olive, 101 Things to Do with Olive Oil. She'll be coming up. She'll be going through hand harvesting and signing her book. So that's coming up in the fall. Date to be decided by the Grove. So again, when we walk the Grove does speak to you if you're quiet and listen. And I'm going to let Daryl talk to you about how we became farmers.
Well, okay, neither of us had a background in agriculture. Olivia was in education, and I did building and investments principally through most of my life. And when I found this property, I recognized it for its commercial potential, and that's what drew me to it. But the very first thing I did was I made it certified organic. And then very shortly, I decided to make olive oil rather than just sell the olives. And as I got involved in learning all about olives, I came to realize this is a traditional grove. It's a very large one. It's the largest planting mission in the world. But the value, the greater value of this property, this parcel, this estate, is to posterity, where it's a place where people can see how agriculture was and how it still can be. And hopefully will be once again. So you can experience nature, you can experience traditional agriculture. And so now we see ourselves as stewards of this property rather than developers of any sort.
Well, I didn't know I'd get the mic back, but Caltrans was going to put a highway through the grove, but as part of their research of the environment, it was discovered that the grove was too historically significant, and they did go around it. And now we have Table Mountain Boulevard as our frontage road. So in 1994, the whole estate became eligible for state and national registries of historic places as the Berkeley Olive Grove District Association. So every bit of it is... Yeah, so we're safe. We're good.
All right. I do like a happy ending once in a while. It's a happy ending, and it's just the beginning. It really, it is. Well, thank you extremely much. We had Olivia and Daryl Grieco here from Berkeley Olive Grove 1913, and we appreciate them being here on KROV Oroville 91.1 FM. And since it's just about noon, here's what we'll do. I'll play the couple of pre-recorded programs of information that we have Tuesdays at noon. Making Contact and TUC Radio. Stick around, please.